Want to try a free sample?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, time to consult the online experts.
You only eat after you're walking 10,000 steps.
Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Signos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Signos.com. Signos.com with code SPARK. Signos.
Centerpiece of the entire web is the use of children for sex.
It was a stunning case that ultimately revealed the secretly perverse lifestyle Wesson had forced his family to lead.
It was more like an organized crime family.
According to Yahweh's law, that was just the way it was supposed to be.
One verse that said, if you don't like him, kill him. I really wish I could find him.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Today, I'm starting a series that God knows how long it's going to be going on. Because right now, my outline is 3 to 4, okay, maybe 5 episodes, but I'm just not sure yet. As I've been researching this for over 6 months. So let's get into it. I know it may seem like I cover a ton of cases that have to do with children, but I'm just shocked and heartbroken at the lack of protection for the most vulnerable of our society. I've questioned this many times in the cases I've covered. The Wesson family, the Kingston clan, Tony Alamo's child brides, Warren Jeffs, the list goes on. But in those cases, for the most part, they kept their secrets off the grid, their victims hidden away. But in the stories I'm about to cover, these victims were being pandered and horrifically abused and possibly even murdered by the authorities, the institutions, and the system that was supposed to protect them. Now let's take the conspiracy theory approach out of this. I totally agree that there are some wild theories out there, and I'm no believer in going down a rabbit hole of like love is one type trajectory, a cult I covered a few episodes back. I don't believe we are all mind controlled or whatever people talk about, and we aren't going to be jumping on a starship and finding utopia. And we aren't even going to get pizza at a gate. Get it? Nope. Okay. But we are going to talk about something that happened decades ago, in the 1970s and 1980s, that is still happening today. Listen, Epstein, Peter Nygaard, Jean-Luc Brunel weren't the first bastards on the block. Groups of people have been exploiting the vulnerable for forever. Sure, we stereotypically think of predators as wayward creeps hiding in the bushes, though that has been largely debunked at this point. But why are we so hesitant to think that someone preying on children could never be a lawyer, a cop, a millionaire businessman? Why is it still so hard to believe that your trusted authority, politician, or executive could prey on children? Though I have done a ton of research into the various forms of sexual deviance and pedophilia and what the most current research says about it, I don't want to pretend to be an authority because it's very complicated. So let's just go with the overarching theme of preying on children. But wouldn't the sexual deviant working at the gas station with the same proclivities as the sexual deviant running a bank, wouldn't they still have a similar wiring? Why would their status change anything? I'll tell you why. Power, access, and more resources to cover it up. And the audacity and authority to shove it right in your face. When I first started researching this, it was just one story, one book, one podcast, one documentary. And then I read more. And then I reread each book, re-listened to, rewatched, and researched online. Randomly found other connections by happenstance, dug deeper and deeper, and I am determined by the end of this series to have some sort of answer. Because there's no way in hell it's not all connected. There, I said it. Okay, so the sin today was supposed to be lust, because it started out as grisly sexual crimes. And that might be its most prominent sin, But man, it's all over the place. It's greed. It's pride. It's undoubtedly wrath. But I think the main root might just be a lust for power and a deviant sexual desire that overrides your basic humanity and makes you a monster. So I'm going to state the sources for this episode up top because the people who really brought this story to light legitimately risked their lives to do so. The late John DeCamp was the pioneer in exposing this story. John was a former Republican Nebraska state senator, Vietnam vet, and successful lawyer. John's first edition of the Franklin cover-up was printed in 1992, just 4 years after this story became public. There were rumblings of it in close circles around the Omaha area and amongst legal and political circles, but it didn't hit the media until years later. John DeCamp has been called a conspiracy theorist, and this story has in recent years mostly sat on the lips of people who could be considered themselves conspiracy theorists. But by the end of this series and the additional cases I'll be connecting, I don't think it will carry that same stigma for you guys. To give full credit to DeCamp and his close connection to this case, I'm going to read directly from the introduction to his book, with a tad bit of paraphrasing because it is lengthy. Quote, "This book will explore the substance of the Franklin case, much of which has never been revealed to the public until now. That means evidence concerning key players, which apparently was never brought before or was ignored by the grand juries. It means evidence gathered for the Nebraska Legislature Special Committee on the Franklin case, which found and verified the tracks of criminal activity where law enforcement purported to see none. The legislative investigation, which began in November 1988, ended on January 9, 1991, when a new legislator was sworn into office, and the investigative committee authorized by the previous legislator was automatically terminated as required by the state constitution. The legislature had the option to renew the investigation, but did not. Many members knew or suspected what the stakes were and were terrified. I write about the unfolding of the Franklin case, its exposure, and its cover-up, as not only an eyewitness, but a participant in these events. I knew how high Larry King's reach went. I was sitting in the front row, just 15 feet from the main podium at the 1984 and 1988 Republican National Conventions. I was there as the story of the Franklin Credit Union and the child abuse broke in Nebraska. I wrote the, quote, DeCamp memo in 1990, which marked a new phase of the case. I will describe events in which I personally was involved. Most of these have never been made public, and it has pained me tremendously at times when I knew that the Omaha World Herald was saying something false or distorting a fact, that I had no forum or no legal right to respond because I had to protect a client or honor a legal privilege. As an attorney, furthermore, I have some specialization in cases of allegations by youngsters against adults in the area of child abuse. Just in the past year, I have overturned two felony charges against individuals in rural Nebraska who were charged with abusing their daughters, based on allegations from the daughters. I was convinced the girls were not telling the truth. I successfully proved this in both cases, and the girls broke down and told the whole story as to why they had lied. In addition, I am the lawyer for the National Child Abuse Defense and Resource Center of Nebraska, which fights against false accusations of child abuse and is made up of adults who have been falsely accused of child abuse. By contrast, with these cases of fantasy, I say without reservation that in one Franklin-related instance after another, there was sufficient evidence and corroboration available for anyone seeking it to back up the victim's stories. My own recollections and considered judgments are just a fraction of the huge record of the Franklin case. The files of the legislature's main investigator, the late Gary Caradori, testify to the mass of leads law enforcement would not pursue. Documentary evidence presented in this book, never before made public, makes it possible to contrast the assurances of local and state officials that there was little or no Franklin-related abuse with what those agencies had in their own files. The chapters of this book dealing with Franklin are based, apart from my own direct experience, strictly on documents available and documented facts. I do not claim to know the accuracy or veracity of every statement made by every witness or other person recorded in these documents. I do claim, however, that the statements and the evidence were officially presented exactly as described. Readers can draw their own conclusions as to what is or is not believable. I have been very careful to present only material and documents which I can legally and properly, in my opinion, make available. End quote. I will say, however, that DeCamp didn't have the luxury of hindsight in 1992 when he wrote his book, because in his intro, he does bring up the McMartin trials and the accusations made of the satanic abuse of children at a preschool in Manhattan Beach, which has now been proven to be false and that the children had been perhaps coerced. But that isn't the case here. And Nick Bryant, author of The Franklin Scandal, A Story of Power Brokers, Child Abuse, and Betrayal, did have hindsight and time on his side. Because when he published his book in 2009, 17 years after John DeCamp's book was published and almost two decades after the investigation was closed, Bryan went into covering his story very skeptical and with a preconceived notion that it very much could be a carefully crafted hoax. That phrase was essentially the final ruling by the powers that be after an extremely shady investigation, which we will be covering. Anyway, Nick Bryant spent 7 years researching and writing his book, meeting with victims, reading as many legal documents regarding the case that he could get his hands on, cross-referencing what DeCamp had uncovered, and expanding on it. By the way, DeCamp and Bryant met, and DeCamp, who had been harassed and threatened for exposing this story, even told Bryant, "Be careful," after giving him some of the leads to contact. And the final person, who never wrote a book on it as he never lived to tell it, was Gary Caradore. Gary Caradore was the investigator for the legislature's Franklin Committee, a private detective hired by the committee who was tasked to look into the accusations on the case. He already had a solid gold reputation for doing anything to find missing persons, abducted children, and teenage girls entrapped in drugs and prostitution. The Lincoln Journal wrote about his endeavors, praising him for going into various disguises to blend in and get these girls out of the most dangerous situations. I can picture it. It almost seems like that scene in True Detective when Matthew McConaughey poses as a drug buddy in a biker gang to investigate his case. We will talk much, much more about Caradore later, but to give you an idea of his dedication, the Lincoln Journal once also quoted him as saying, "If I didn't have to make a living, I'd track them down for free." Do you ever feel like you're being followed around the internet? Maybe advertisers know a bit too much about you. Our new sponsor, IPVanish VPN, is here to help you take back your privacy and help become anonymous on the internet. So what is IPVanish? IPVanish is a virtual private network, a VPN for short. A VPN is a super important tool that helps you safely browse the internet. You can use a VPN on your computers, tablets, phones, even things like your Fire Stick when you're streaming media. When you use a VPN, all of your data is encrypted. What you're reading, what you're searching, what you're watching, whatever it is that you're doing. That's important because what you're doing on the internet is no one else's business but yours. IPVanish helps you remain anonymous and secure on the internet. For listeners of the show, IPVanish is offering an incredible 65% off. That's just $3.49 for the first month, or $31.49 for the first year. Here's everything you get with IPVanish. Anonymous IP addresses. That means your personal IP address can't be tracked by anyone on the web. You can circumvent any online censorship. IPVanish has more than 1,500 servers in 70-plus locations. You get protection when using public Wi-Fi. Remember, with IPVanish, all your data is encrypted, so no one can snoop on what you're doing. 24/7 support. Email them, chat with them, even call them. They are there to help. So go to IPVanish.com/sinners. Claim your 65% savings. They have plans starting at just $3.49 or $31.49 a year. This is the time to sign up. With our discount and their current promotional offerings, you can get a VPN for 65% off their usual offering. IPVanish is the best of the best. It's even rated 4.7 out of 5 on Trustpilot, and that's with more than 6,000 reviews. Remember, it's ipvanish.com/sinners to get the deal and start protecting yourself online. So let me set the tone. Picture a lavish party at an upscale high-rise in Nebraska. You're 14 years old. You come from a religious family and have never experienced anything like this. You're brought there by some boys your age you met at a dance. You walk in. It's opulent. You feel sophisticated and a little rebellious. Then there's cocaine on the table. And adult men, 3 to 5 times your age, who are mingling about and drinking. But then something feels off. Maybe it's the fact that there are 6 adults and 20 minors in attendance. Or maybe it's the fact that there's explicit abuse material of underage boys playing on the big TV screen. Or maybe it was that you, as a 14-year-old child, were being fed booze and drugs, and that the adults had made up some friendly game of 501 they were having the youngsters play. 501 meant telling underage minors to try and unzip each other's pants with their teeth as the adults watched on. Alicia Owen, who we will hear a ton about more later, was this girl. She was young, naive, wanting to have fun and what 14-year-old doesn't, but she was too sheltered to discern exactly what was okay, and she didn't have the voice yet to tell anyone. Many of the men at this party, as we will come to find out, also touted extracurricular volunteer positions on their resumes, such as president of the Omaha Girls Club and a board member for the Boys Club, Big Brothers, the Utihaly Home for Girls, and more. According to Alicia, in attendance, among other men, were Larry King, Alan Bear, and a guy named Rob. She and the other miners there knew that they had to have been amongst high society. I mean, they looked the part, they acted the part. It was intoxicatingly eerie. The rest of what happened during Alicia's visits to Larry King's apartment will make your blood boil. But let's get context before we get graphic. If you haven't heard of the Franklin scandal, which I hadn't until 6 months ago, but as a person engulfed in the true crime world, I was surprised I hadn't. And like I said earlier, if you Wikipedia the Franklin scandal, it's going to end with it saying, quote, "It was a carefully crafted hoax by authorities." But it's just not true. Besides the actual documentation and scary connections and associations that have been reported, the overwhelming amount of evidence and the voices of the victims, I mean, a person simply can't pretend it didn't happen. You could be the best actor in the world, and you shouldn't be able to say with a straight face, it was a hoax. The problem was that many were too afraid to even utter the words, the Franklin scandal. Many who knew it was happening were bullied and outright threatened for even talking about it. On top of that, there are suicides that don't quite make sense. A bomb that was detonated in the backyard of a concerned mother who formed a support network for other parents regarding the case. Yes, that happened. A bomb was detonated in her backyard. And then there's the palpable fear the victims felt, that if they talked, something terrible would happen to them or their families. Also, remember mysterious suicides for a future episode, when we connect an entirely different, but possibly connected group, operating during this time. CBD isn't about what you feel. It's about what you don't feel, the stress, the anxiety, the pain. And for me, a lot of time it's sleeplessness. When I'm super busy, I can't go to sleep because my brain just goes. But CBD from Feels has truly helped me relax, fall asleep, and take a much needed edge off. And Feels is the better way to feel better. Feels is a premium CBD that will help to keep your head clear and feel your best. It's hassle-free, delivered directly to your door. CBD naturally helps reduce stress, anxiety, pain, and sleeplessness. And there's no hangover or addiction. You just place a few drops of Feels under your tongue, and you feel the difference within minutes. I can attest to this. And the thing to remember about CBD is that finding your right dose is important, and everyone's dose is different. For example, if my mom was to take CBD, she'd need a pediatric dose. I could probably take quite a bit more. But if you're confused about it, Feels offers a free CBD hotline to help guide your personal experience so that you find your perfect dose. The Feels customer service team is dedicated to making sure you get the best use of your CBD. Joining the Feels monthly membership makes your self-care easy. And who doesn't want that? You'll save money on every order, and you can pause or cancel at any time. So start feeling better with Feels. Become a member today by going to feels.com/sinners, and you'll get 50% off your first order with free shipping. That's Feels, FEALS.com/sinners, to become a member and get 50% automatically taken off your first order with free shipping. Feels.com/sinners. So who is Larry King? The leader of this, and where the namesake of the Franklin scandal comes into play. Lawrence King was born September 7th, 1944, to hardworking parents who were devout Presbyterians. His father, nicknamed Poncho, and his mother, Vanetta, by all accounts, they seemed to be supportive parents. They even encouraged their son, Larry, to pursue singing lessons, who had already begun impressing those around him with his voice. Larry sang at church, in the choir, and truly became known for it. As a teen, Larry King did a good job in high school. He graduated and attended Omaha University for a time, and then eventually signed up for the Air Force. He met and married his wife Alice during those years, and then settled back in Omaha and entered a bank management training program. Not long after finishing, he landed the job as the head of the Franklin Credit Union, a floundering bank that wasn't said to have held more than $100,000 at that point. Yet King somehow went from a middle-class wage of $17,000 to upgrading his life at record speed. He wore flashy suits. He kept moving into larger houses and driving fancier cars. More and more money kept flowing in, and people took notice. But they didn't know how he was making this kind of money. Turns out, one of King's crimes was running a Ponzi scheme of sorts. He was scamming people into buying overpriced CDs and then covering the cost with more CD sales. And many large corporations and well-known businessmen bought into this. Harold Anderson, Omaha World Herald publisher, who served as chairman of Franklin Credit Union's advisory board, even held a fund drive that raised over $672,000. That was a lot of money back then. And one thing Larry King did with that money was build a bedroom in the bank's basement. The bedroom was fully equipped with a TV, a brass bed, linens, and repulsion. Okay, repulsion wasn't reported anywhere. That came from me. But the reasoning for having a basement bedroom, King said to a former Franklin employee, was that he needed it to unwind, and that one of the security guards also temporarily lived there. According to Nick Bryant's book, Nick spoke with one of the security guards who briefly inhabited Larry King's basement bedroom at the credit union. Quote, he alleged one of his first official duties as a Franklin security guard was performing oral sex on Larry King in the basement bedroom, end quote. Larry King was making money fast and acquiring cronies from all levels of power. He also switched his political affiliation from Democrat to Republican after skyrocketing his wealth and was soon called, quote, the fastest rising African-American star in the Republican Party. He was even honored at a 1983 reception for his service to the Republican Party, both locally and nationally. And his growing political affiliations, of course, required him to rent himself a townhouse in one of the most prestigious neighborhoods in Washington, D.C. He threw parties at his D.C. residence, his Omaha penthouse, and even a party at a Texas ranch. It was in Dallas that he would do a second rendition of the Star Spangled Banner, the first one notably impressing Ronald and Nancy Reagan at a 1982 National Black Republican Council dinner that they were attending. To be fair, he does have a nice voice. And does know how to put on a show, albeit creepy and over the top, at the party he threw at the lavish Texas ranch. Teenagers dressed as cowgirls welcomed the partygoers, which included more political elite, including Reagan's daughter Maureen, who was seen hugging him in a photo. His party's guest list included everyone from Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, United States Ambassador to the United Nations Jeannie Kirkpatrick, New York Congressman Jack Kemp, and two men that would also serve on Franklin Credit Union's advisory board, Nebraska Congressman Hal Dobb and Omaha World Herald publisher Harold Anderson, along with prominent businessman and millionaire Alan Baer, a department store heir amongst other endeavors he did, and Peter Citron, an Omaha World Herald columnist, and Omaha Police Chief Robert Wadman. It's not to say that all these people knew what was going on, but some didn't just know what was going on. They participated and helped facilitate one of the largest and most corrupt pedophile rings this country has ever seen, and refused to acknowledge it. Larry King also kept a lover by the name of Charlie Rogers. Not underage, but a young man who got in way over his head, and he knew it. According to Nick Bryant's book, Franklin Scandal, he was able to find substantial corroboration connecting Rogers and King. Rogers was a handsome bodybuilder type who owned a lawn service business and worked as a bouncer part-time at the Max, a popular gay club in Omaha that King was a regular at. Charlie and King met at the Max, but their relationship extended beyond that. Lavish gifts, expensive flowers, and a bracelet King purchased for Rogers that had Charlie engraved on the bracelet's top side and "From the Boss" was engraved on the underside. In Rogers' pocketbook of telephone numbers, the name King was accompanied by five different numbers. November 10th, 1986. Charlie Rogers was found fully clothed with a fatal shotgun wound to the head. A shotgun resting between his legs and the barrel of the gun pointed at his head. His TV was on, and there was no suicide note. His apartment's front door was locked, but the door to his third floor deck was unlocked. His death was ruled a suicide, but what happened in the weeks leading up to his death made his family and friends question the circumstances. According to Nick Bryant's book, quote, he was very close to his mother and younger sister, and both told law enforcement that he surely would have left a suicide note. Approximately 3 weeks before Roger's death, he stopped by his mother's house for a roast beef dinner, a routine ritual in his life. He told her that he had a plane ticket to Washington, D.C., but he decided not to use it and asked her if she wanted to fly to Washington, D.C. His mother declined her son's offer and abruptly cut short their conversation about the ticket. In retrospect, she felt Rogers was attempting to explain the ticket to her. Therefore, she deeply regretted interrupting him. After Rogers' death, his mother found the plane ticket while sorting through his possessions. The Franklin Credit Union had purchased the ticket for Rogers. He was slated to fly out of Omaha at 11:25 a.m., make a stopover in Minneapolis, and arrive in Washington, D.C. at 4:35 p.m. On the same day, he would leave D.C. at 8 p.m., and after a stopover in Minneapolis, return to Omaha at 10:57 p.m. She felt it was very strange that someone at the Franklin Credit Union, presumably King, wanted her son to be in D.C. for just 3.5 hours. A week or so after Roger's conversation with his mother about the D.C. ticket, he visited his 26-year-old younger sister and her husband. He had about 2 weeks to live. Rogers showed up at their place around 10 p.m. Rogers and his kid sister were very close, and she immediately noticed that Rogers, who was usually very effervescent and a prankster, appeared extremely tense and paranoid. Rogers had a lot on his mind, and he would spend the next 4 or 5 hours talking to his sister and brother-in-law. Rogers had a nickname for his little sister, Crunch, and he piped, "Crunch, I think I'm in trouble." Rogers then alluded to the fact that he was living a double life. But he said for the physical welfare of his sister and her husband, he wouldn't divulge many of the specifics. He told them that he was attempting to extricate himself from an endeavor that was seemingly ominous. Though he wouldn't specifically state the particulars of the endeavor, he said it was connected to a very powerful individual whose name was Larry King. His sister had never heard of Larry King before, and she didn't have the foggiest clue about King or the Franklin Credit Union. Rogers disclosed to his sister that he had been enmeshed with King for a couple of months, and he took several trips with him, primarily to Washington, D.C., and he said he received approximately $50,000 from King. Rogers revealed that King was connected to people who harnessed unbelievable power. He mentioned four or five times that he was merely a bug on the floor and these power brokers had the ability to squash him at will. Rogers then conveyed to his sister and brother-in-law a rather mind-boggling account of that power. The power brokers had the juice to completely erase people's backgrounds and insert them into high-ranking political positions. Rogers told his sister that he wanted out of King's sphere because he had a renewed relationship with a former boyfriend who disapproved of King's activities. Before Rogers left his sister's house at approximately 3 a.m. the following morning, he gave his sister a pair of letters King had written to him. Rogers also gave his sister a small stationery card that had Larry King inscribed on the front. He departed his sister's house in the wee hours, and she would never see him alive again. Though the three talked for hours, his fear for his life hadn't abated in the least. Shortly before his departure, he told his sister and brother-in-law that if something happened to him or he went missing, they should contact the Douglas County Deputy Attorney, Bob Sigler. He said Sigler would be fully cognizant of his situation. End quote.
Want to try a free sample?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, time to consult the online experts.
You only eat after you're walking 10,000 steps.
Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com, Cygnos.com, with code SPARK. Cygnos.
Are you like me and pause the episode you're listening to Google the people they are talking about, or occasionally the crime scene if it's not too scary? I thought so. Then let me tell you about an amazing new immersive podcast app, Vodacast, that will allow you to experience this podcast and others in a way you haven't been able to until now. Vodacast will provide you with a deeper version of the show and allow you to view photos of the people and places we're talking about on this episode. You'll also get links for articles about the case. When you experience a podcast on Vodacast, you're not only listening to your favorite podcast, but you'll be getting the stories that come alive with supplemental digital content that allows you to have everything being discussed in the episode at your fingertips. With Vodacast, it's all right there. So try Vodacast out today. Click on the link in my show notes to learn more about Vodacast or download the app in the App Store and change the way you experience podcasts forever. That's Vodacast, V-O-D-A-C-A-S-T. A few days prior to his death, Charlie Rogers had been in good spirits. He spoke to his mom on the phone. The only red flag, it seemed, was the night of his death. He'd gotten into a physical altercation with his boyfriend outside the Max. But by the fact that he went and visited the boyfriend in the hospital, as the boyfriend needed a small amount of stitches from the scuffle, one would assume they worked it out. But no one will ever know exactly what was on his mind. But within hours, Charlie was dead. When the time was right, Charlie's sister and brother-in-law told Charlie's mom that he had mentioned fearing for his life a few weeks prior, and that he had alluded to living a double life. They also told her that Charlie said to contact Bob Sigler if anything happened to him. So later that day, they called Bob Sigler, who was the Douglas County deputy attorney. Bob Sigler claimed he had no idea he would be contacted if something happened and said that his only connection to Charlie was that he had handled a few misdemeanor cases for Charlie when he was in private practice. All of this was then punctuated with a letter from Larry King asking that the grieving mother return a pager Larry gave him. The letter said, quote, "Please accept my sincere sympathy on Charlie's death. After having Charlie as an employee, I was very sad to read about your loss. Unfortunately, I must ask a favor of you at this time. Charlie had a paging beeper provided by us that he used when he worked. End quote. Why would you need the pager back? Aren't you rich, Larry? They now understood why Charlie was so afraid of Larry King. They were now afraid of Larry King. To close out this episode, I want to cut back to Larry King's penthouse and Alicia Owens' story. Trigger warning. This is going to get very graphic. If you're sensitive to stories about child sexual abuse, you might want to skip this. At that first party, Alicia, by her own admission, had tried cocaine for the first time. She got drunk. But she still remembers seeing adults fondling minors, and then them going in and out of rooms with them. She did not participate in sexual acts at the first party, she said. She got home, an hour past her curfew, and her concerned parents scolded her, but nothing seemed that amiss. A few days later, she got a call from a boy named Troy Bonner, who she met at the party and had exchanged numbers with. He regaled her with how fun that night was and that she should come there the following Friday night. They were having another party. She agreed and told her parents that she was staying the night at a friend's house. Upon arriving to the party, this time, along with Larry King, Alan Bear, and Rob, World Herald columnist Peter Citron was there. She remembers mixing champagne and cognac and got very drunk. She was trying to stumble to the bathroom, then she accidentally entered a bedroom where she saw a young boy performing oral sex on Larry King. Again, this is all per her recollection, recorded in court documents and the two books written about this. Then Rob, an adult male, asked her to unzip his pants with her teeth, in the middle of the room, with others watching. When she refused, she was made fun of for being such a little girl. So she relented. He put a pillow under her knees as she attempted to unzip his pants. He stroked her hair. And then he sat back in the chair like some sort of don, holding a glass of cognac. He then asked her to sit on his lap. He started touching her breasts and legs, and in Alicia's account, she said she remembers thinking he was a nice man. Again, she's 14. Completely new to any scenario like this. Though, I don't think even in my 30s I would know what to do or say. It's just scary. That night, after Rob left, she lost her virginity to Troy Bonner. According to Alicia, she thought that's what she was supposed to do that night, making her more sexually accessible to her new friends. 3 weeks later, she went to another party at the penthouse. Rob arrived about an hour after her. She felt like someone at the party must have called him to tell him that she was there and to come. They were then left alone in the living room. He pulled the 14-year-old girl onto his lap, complimented her looks, and then said that he knew she had lost her virginity. As he was groping her, he asked if her parents knew she was no longer a virgin. She was so embarrassed and scared in that moment that he might tell her parents that she had been promiscuous. He then started to remove her jumpsuit, and she asked him to stop, and she put her hands up. Then he gripped her wrist and twisted it, then said, "You have a pretty mouth. Do you know the meaning of fellatio?" Then told her to keep saying the word over and over, and that he would teach her the word's meaning. He removed her clothing, put a pillow under her knees, unzipped his pants, and forced her to perform oral sex on him. After it was over, she ran to the bathroom, vomited, and started crying. When she emerged from the bathroom, Rob hugged her and said he was sorry. He then said, "I'd like to take you to lunch this Wednesday. Go pick out a dress at the downtown department store." This upscale department store was owned by Alan Bear. She was then given a ride home by other partygoers, and it was on this ride that she was told Rob was Robert Wadman, the Omaha police chief. Sorry to leave you guys disgusted and just hanging there, but there's so much more to come, and I'm so sorry to say it's going to get much worse. But these kids, like Alicia, did not make this up, and their stories deserve to be heard. There's decades of corroboration you will hear in the next few episodes and beyond. So thank you guys so much for listening. And if you're enjoying the show, please tell a friend. Leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Bye.